This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This opening music is courtesy of Joseph Martin, Professor of Music at the Lamont School of Music at Denver University. Welcome to the Poetry Corner. Before W.S. Gilbert partnered with Arthur Sullivan to produce their many operettas, he was known as a comic poet. Here is one of his offerings, The Yarn of the Nancy Bell. 'Twas on the shores and round our coast from Deal to Ramsgate span that I found alone on a piece of stone an elderly naval man. His hair was weedy, his beard was long, and weedy and long was he. And I heard this wight on the shore recite in a singular minor key, "Oh, I am a cook, and the captain bold, and the mate of the Nancy Brig, and a bo'sun tied in a midshipmite, and the crew of the captain's gig." And he shook his fists and he tore his hair till I really felt afraid, for I couldn't help thinking the man had been drinking, and so I simply said, "Oh, elderly man, it's little I know of the duties of men of the sea, and I'll eat my hand if I understand how you can possibly be at once a cook and a captain bold and a mate of the Nancy Brig, and a bo'sun tight and a midshipmite, and the crew of the captain's gig." Then he gave me a hitch to his trousers, which is a trick all seamen learn, and having got rid of a thumping quid, he spun his painful yarn. 'Twas in the good ship Nancy Bell that we sailed to the Indian Sea, and there on a reef we came to grief, which has often occurred to me. And pretty near nigh all the crew was drowned, there was 77 a soul, and only 10 of the Nancy's men said here to the muster roll. There was me and the cook, and the captain bold, and the mate of the Nancy Brig, and the bo'sun tight, and a midship mite, and the crew of the captain's gig. For a month we'd neither whittles nor drunk, till a hungry we did feel, so we drawed a lot, and accordingly shot the captain for our meal. The next lot fell to the Nancy's mate, and a delicate dish he made, then our appetite with the midship mite, we 7 survivors stayed. And then we murdered the bo'sun tight, and he much resembled pig. Then we whittled free, did the cook and me, on the crew of the captain's gig. Then only the cook and me was left, and the delicate question, which of us two goes to the kettle, arose, and we argued it out as sich. For I loved that cook as a brother, I did, and the cook, he worshipped me, and we both be blowed if we'd either be stowed in the other chap's hold, you see. "I'll be eaten if you dines off me," says Tom. "Yes, that," says I, "you'll be. I'm boiled if I die, my friend," quoth I, "and exactly so," quoth he. Says he, "Dear James, to murder me were a foolish thing to do, for don't you see that you can't cook me while I can and will cook you?" So he boils the water and takes the salt and the pepper in portions true, which he never forgot, and some chopped shallot and some sage and parsley, too. "Come here," says he, with a proper pride, which his smiling features tell, "'twill soothing be if I let you see how extremely nice you'll smell." And he stirred it round and round and round, and he sniffed at the foaming froth, when I ups his heels and smothers his squeals in the scum of the boiling broth. And I eat that cook, and a week or less, and, as I eating be, the last of his chops, why, I almost drops, for a vessel in sight I see. And I never larf, and I never smile, and I never lark or play, but sit and croak in a single joke I have, which is to say, "Oh, I am a cook, and a captain bold, and the mate of the Nancy Brig, and a bo'sun tight, and a midship mite, and the crew of the captain's gig." Now from the Nancy Bell to the shores of Ireland, with some thoughts about the snakes, or lack thereof, on the Emerald Isle. St. Patrick was a gentleman who, through strategy and stealth, drove all the snakes from Ireland. Here's a bumper to his health. But not too many bumpers, lest we lose ourselves and then forget the good St. Patrick and see the snakes again. That may recall the days of the WCTU, That was the Women's Christian Temperance Union for our younger listeners. When the rallying cry was, "Lips that taste wine shall never touch mine." Well, Ireland was just a bit apart from Scotland, and Robert Burns, writing in the late 1700s, offered the following. John Barleycorn. There were three kings into the east, three kings both great and high, and they had sworn a solemn oath, John Barleycorn should die. They took a plow and plowed him down, put clods upon his head, and they had sworn a solemn oath, John Barleycorn was dead. But the cheerful spring came kindly on, and showers began to fall. John Barleycorn got up again, and sore surprised them all. The sultry suns of summer came, and he grew thick and strong, his head well armed with pointed spears, that no one should do him wrong. The sober autumn entered mild, when he grew wan and pale. His bending joints and drooping head showed he'd begun to fail. His colors sickened more and more. He faded into age. And then his enemies began to show their deadly rage. They'd taken a weapon, long and sharp, and cut him by the knee, then tied him fast upon a cart, like a rogue for forgery. They laid him down upon his back, and cudgeled him full sore. They hung him up before the storm, and turned him o'er and o'er. They filled up a darksome pit with water to the brim. They heaved in John Barleycorn, there let him sink or swim. They laid him out upon the floor to work him further woe, and still, as signs of life appeared, they tossed him to and fro. They wasted o'er a scorching flame the marrow of his bones, but a miller used him worst of all. He crushed him between two stones. And they had taken his very heart's blood and drank it round and round, and still the more and more they drank, their joy did more abound. John Barleycorn was a hero bold of noble enterprise, for if you do but taste his blood, 'twill make your courage rise. 'Twill make a man forget his woe, 'twill heighten all his joy. 'Twill make the widow's heart to sing, though the tear were in her eye. Then let us toast John Barleycorn, each man a glass in hand, and may his great posterity ne'er fail in old Scotland. Perhaps we need a middle ground between those two points of view, and I think I found one from Lord Neaves, a Scottish judge writing in the mid-1800s. His poem is entitled, "I'm Very Fond of Water," and subtitled, "A New Temperance Song." I'm very fond of water, I drink at noon and night. Not Rakehab's son or daughter had therein more delight. I breakfast on it daily, and nectar it doth seem, when once I've mixed it gaily with sugar and with cream. But I forgot to mention that in it first I see, infused or in suspension, good mocha or bohea. I'm very fond of water, I drink at noon and night. No mother's son or daughter had therein more delight. At luncheon, too, I drink it, and strength it seems to bring, when really good, I think, a liquor for a king. But I forgot to mention, 'tis best to be sincere, I use an old invention that makes it into beer. I'm very fond of water, I drink it noon and night. No mother, son, or daughter hath therein more delight. I drink it, too, at dinner, I quaff it full and free, and find, as I'm a sinner, it does not disagree, but I forgot to mention, and thus I drink and dine, to obviate distention, I join some sherry wine. I'm very fond of water, I drink it noon and night, no mother, son, or daughter hath therein more delight. And then when dinner's over and business far away, I feel myself in clover and sip my eau sucrée. But I forgot to mention, to give the glass a smack, I add, with due attention, Glenlivet or cognac. I'm very fond of water, I drink it noon and night, no mother, son, or daughter hath therein more delight. At last when evening closes with something nice to eat, the best of sleeping dozes and water still I meet. But I forgot to mention, I think it not a sin, to cheer the day's declension by pouring in some gin. I'm very fond of water. It ever must delight each mother, son, or daughter, when qualified aright. Everyone knows there's going to be a morning after, so we offer a work of American humorist George Ade, writing at the beginning of the 20th century. This piece originally appeared in the comic opera The Sultan of Sulu. R-E-M-O-R-S-E. The cocktail is a pleasant drink. It's mild and harmless, I don't think. When you've had one, you call for two, and then you don't care what you do. Last night I hoisted 23 of those arrangements into me. My wealth increased. I swelled with pride. I was pickled, primed, and ossified. But R-E-M-O-R-S-E. The water wagon is the place for me. Last night at 12 I felt immense. Today I feel like 30 cents. My eyes are bleared, my copper's hot. I'd like to eat, but I cannot. It's no time for mirth and laughter, the cold gray dawn of the morning after. If ever I want to sign the pledge, it's the morning after I've had an edge. When I've been full of the oil of joy and fancied I was a sporty boy, the world was one kaleidoscope of purple bliss, transcendent hope. But now I'm feeling mighty blue. Three cheers for the WCTU. R-E-M-O-R-S-E. Those dry martinis did the work for me. A dark brown taste, a burning thirst, a head that's ready to split and burst. I like to hold it under a pump. When I hear a noise, I want to jump. It is no time for mirth and laughter. The cold gray dawn of the morning after. Such may lead to introspection, as suggested by this work from a recent poet and magazine editor, Larry Flint. Diagnosis. It's a bitter old world, is it not? It's a dreary old place, am I right? It's a dirty old deal. Oh, I know how you feel. You are in such a terrible plight. But the sky, well, it seems to be blue, but there's music enough in the trees, and the sun's shining bright, and the earth is all right, so I wouldn't blame it on these. It's a rugged old road at the best, sure I know, and you're sick of the gloom. But there's nothing much wrong with a bobolink song, or the way that the daffodils bloom. Why, the bluebirds are cheering you on, and the ground's even soft where you fall. Not a thing's out of whack on the little old track, so maybe it's you after all. And maybe the result of that introspection might come from Indiana poet Barton Rees Pogue. I wish I could learn to laugh at myself. I wish I could learn to laugh at myself, somehow have the wisdom to see that the very best joke in all of the world is the fellow that I call me. I know I'm not Utopia's king. I allow I'm a laughable joint. But in spite of the fact that I know I'm a joke, I never have quite seen the point. I wish I could learn to laugh at myself, to roar at my funny ears, fall in a fit at the sight of my legs and the way my big nose steers. If I could only laugh like you always do at the whimsical things I have done, I'd start in and laugh out the days of old age and surely have lots of fun. I wish I could learn to laugh at myself. 'Twould save me a lot of conceit and show me that out of earth's harvest of souls, I'm not quite the choice of the wheat. 'Twould save me from being a Pharisee, from looking on life so sour, and seriously thinking to save mankind by the strength of my own great power. Oh, I wish I could learn to laugh at myself, for it seems that a good funny streak would help me rejoice in the strength of the strong and lend a kind hand to the weak. 'Twould level my airs and pull up my gloom and make me a man loved of men. So here's to the hope that I start in today and never stop laughing again. One unknown author may have found a very good way to start laughing at yourself with a poem entitled The Merry-Making Parson. A teacher in a Sunday school, to give her class delight, had all her little students at a party Christmas night. The parson of the church had heard the children would convene and thought it would be jolly to look in upon the scene. And so he donned his coat and hat and happily set out to see his little flock at play, a pastoral good scout. He rang the doorbell and, admitted to the entrance hall, he told the servant, "Don't announce me. I'll surprise 'em all." With coat and hat removed, the parson quietly drew near the spacious parlors from whence came the buzz of voices clear. Then down on hands and knees he went and bounded in that way, emitting funny noises, something like a horse's neigh. A deadly silence followed. He glanced upward from the floor and saw a formal dinner group. His kiddies were next door. Laughing at yourself may yield an unexpected insight, a look into the life of another. Mary Mapes Dodge of New York was married in 1851 and had two children. Her husband experienced financial difficulty in 1858 and left the family. A month after his disappearance, he was found drowned. The wife took to writing and produced a well-known book, Hans Brinker, or The Silver Skates. She also penned the following piece of an insight gained in looking back a generation. The poem is entitled The Minuet. Grandma told me all about it, told me so I couldn't doubt it, how she danced, my grandma danced, long ago. How she held her pretty head, how her dainty skirt she spread, how she slowly leaned and rose, long ago. Grandma's hair was bright and sunny, dimpled cheeks too, oh, how funny, really quite a pretty girl, long ago. Bless her, why she wears a cap, Grandma does, and takes a nap every single day, and yet Grandma danced the minuet, long ago. Modern ways are quite alarming, Grandma says, but boys were charming, girls and boys, she means, of course, long ago. Brave and modest, grandly shy, she would like to have us try, just to feel like those who met in the graceful minuet long ago. That same thought might apply to this next piece by Rudyard Kipling. Born in India in 1865, he is probably best known for his Just So stories, which explain things like how the elephant got his tail, and The Adventures of Mowgli, which became the Disney version of The Jungle Book. And of his serious poetry, his most famous line is probably, "You are a better man than I am, Gunga Din." He also wrote this following piece, entitled simply, If. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them with worn-out tools, if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss, if you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch, If neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but not too much. If you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Introspection raises the question of where we are and what we do there. In 1883, Ella Wheeler Wilcox wrote a piece whose first line has become one of the most well-known lines in modern conversation, but the rest of the poem is often forgotten. Here is the whole piece, entitled Solitude. Laugh and the world laughs with you. Weep and you weep alone. For the sad old earth must borrow its mirth, but has trouble enough of its own. Sing, and the hills will answer. Sigh, it is lost on the air. The echoes bound to a joyful sound, but shrink from voicing care. Rejoice, and men will seek you. Grieve, and they will turn and go. They want full measure of all your pleasure, but they do not need your woe. Be glad, and your friends are many. Be sad, and you lose them all. There are none to decline your nectared wine, but alone you must drink life's gall. Feast, and your halls are crowded, fast, and the world goes by. Succeed and give, and it helps you live, but no man can help you die. There is room in the halls of pleasure for a long and lordly train, but one by one we must all file on through the narrow aisles of pain. But choices are always present, as expressed in this next piece by Sam Walter Foss. The author was born in New Hampshire in 1858. He lost his mother at the age of 4 and worked on his father's farm for many years. Eventually, he graduated from Brown University in 1882 and wrote this poem, A House by the Side of the Road. There are hermit souls that live withdrawn in the place of their self-content. There are souls like stars that dwell apart in a fellowless firmament. There are pioneer souls that blaze their paths where highways never ran. But let me live by the side of the road and be a friend to man. Let me live in a house by the side of the road where the race of men go by, the men who were good and the men who were bad, as good and as bad as I. I would not sit in the scorner's seat or hurl the cynic's ban. Let me live in a house by the side of the road and be a friend to man. I see from my house by the side of the road, by the side of the highway of life, the men who press with the ardor of hope, the men who are faint with the strife. But I turn not away from their smiles nor their tears, both parts of the infinite plan. Let me live in a house by the side of the road and be a friend to man. I know there are brook-gladdened meadows ahead and the mountains of wearisome height, that the road passes on through the long afternoon and stretches away to the night. But still I rejoice when the travelers rejoice and weep with the strangers that moan, nor live in my house by the side of the road like a man who dwells alone. Let me live in my house by the side of the road. It's here the race of men go by. They are good, they are bad, they are weak, they are strong, wise, foolish. So am I. Then why should I sit in the scorner's seat or hurl the cynic's ban? Let me live in my house by the side of the road and be a friend to man. That thought may be behind one poem written by author Jason Lee Henry Hunt. From the beginning of the 19th century, Abu Bin Adam. Abu Bin Adam, may his tribe increase, awoke one night from a deep dream of peace, and saw within the moonlight in his room, making it rich and like a lily in bloom, an angel writing in a book of gold. Exceeding peace had made Bin Adam bold, and to the presence of the room he said, "What writest thou?" The vision raised its head, and with a look made of all sweet accord, answered, "The names of those who love the Lord." "And is mine one?" said Abu. "Nay, not so," replied the angel. Abu spoke more low but cheerily still, and said, "I pray thee then, write me as one who loves his fellow men." The angel wrote and vanished. The next night it came again with a great wakening light, and showed the names whom love of God had blessed, and lo, Ben Adam's name led all the rest. But what if? One possible answer comes from John Milton, the author of Paradise Lost. From his 17th century poem, On His Blindness. When I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent, which is death to hide, lodge with me useless, though my soul more bent, to serve therewith my Maker and present my true account, lest he, returning, chide? Doth God exact day labor, light denied? I fondly ask. But patience, to prevent the murmur, soon replies, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best him bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly, thousands at his bidding speed, and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. Regardless of where it happens, many believe that it starts and ends at home. So, from James Whitcomb Riley, When the Frost is on the Pumpkin. When the frost is on the pumpkin and the fodder's in the shock, and you hear the clack and gobble of the strutting turkey cock, and the clacking of the guineas and the clucking of the hens, and the rooster's hallelujah as he tiptoes on the fence, oh, it's then's the times a feller is a-feeling at his best, with the rising sun to greet him from a night of peaceful rest. And he leaves the house bareheaded, and he goes out to feed the stock, where the frost is on the pumpkin, and the fodder's in the shock. There's something kind of hearty-like about the atmosphere when the heat of summer's over and the cooling fall is here. Of course we miss the flowers and the blossoms on the trees, and the mumble of the hummingbirds and the buzzing of the bees. But the air's so appetizing, and the landscape through the haze of a crisp and sunny morning of the early autumn days is a picture that no painter has a color in a mock when the frost is on the pumpkin and the fodder's in the shock. And husky, rusty rustles of the tossels of the corn, and the rasping of the tangled leaves as golden as the morn, the stubble and the furries, kind of lonesome-like, but still, are preaching sermons to us of the barns they grow to fill. The straw stack in the meadow, and the reaper in the shed, the horses in their stalls below, the clover overhead. Oh, it sets my heart a-clickin' like the tickin' of a clock, when the frost is on the pumpkin, and the fodder's in the shock. Then your apples are all gathered, and the ones a feller keeps is poured around the cellar floor in red and yeller heaps. And your cider making's over, and your women folks is through with their mince and apple butter and their sauce and sausage too. I don't know how to tell it, but if such a thing could be as the angels want in Borden and they come around to me, I'd want to accommodate 'em, all the whole enduring flock, when the frost is on the pumpkin and the fodder's in the shock. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And thank you for listening in to The Poetry Corner.